Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
Adam, on our show today, we get to talk with father-daughter co-authors, Mr. Mark Silver and Ms. Maya Silver, about this topic, My Parent or Friend Has Cancer, and specifically about their new book.
You know, Christy, there's so many of our patients, friends, and family members who've had parents who had cancer, and I know you've shared on this show several times about your own experience with a parent and father with cancer. So this is a difficult subject, important subject, and I'm glad we're going to have the conversation.
I am too, but first we have some research that matters, Adam. We're going to talk about caffeine enhancing memory.
I'm glad to hear that because my caffeine consumption is pretty high. About words really matter when the doctor uses words that are positive or negative.
About a different way to reframe performance anxiety.
And then finally, we're going to talk just real briefly about two new potential diagnostic studies, one for melanoma and one for gluten celiac disease.
Yep. So let's talk about caffeine and memory. Of course, this piqued our attention because both of us are coffee drinkers and appreciate the value of caffeine. We know that there's, you know, a lot of people use it and that there's all this research and benefits to health and for awakeness and alertness and performance. But this was a study looking at memory in people.
So this was in the journal Nature Neuroscience, and this was all over the news recently. Researchers at Johns Hopkins University, and what they really wanted to see is when people took a 200 milligram caffeine tablet, which is a good strong cup of coffee, what would happen after they were given a series of images that they might then show a day later, and would they remember the images? And if they changed them and subtly made them a little different, would people know they were a little different or not? This is some really fine memory recall issues.
And so half of the group got the caffeine and half of the group got a placebo pill. And then the next day, both groups were tested on their ability to recognize these images. And they found that the people who had the caffeine did better and had a stronger memory of those images compared with the people who didn't.
Yeah, they hypothesized that this memory center in the human brain, the hippocampus, which I always love it. You know, I love that name, hippocampus.
Hungry hippo.
And it's a seahorse-shaped area in the brain. If you see the picture of it, it looks like a seahorse. I got to love both those things there. But that's what turns on the on and off this memory area. And it appears that this caffeine might really have some effect at the hippocampus. And I love this kind of research, Christy. It's another thing that coffee could be good for you. Certainly
maybe
didn't hurt their memory.
Maybe that's why you're so smart, Adam.
Well, at least I remember things better than I did.
That's true. That's good.
Smartness I'm working on.
All right. Well, let's talk about the next one. And this is about choosing words and the power of words in understanding a patient's healthcare experience.
We know, Christy, that, you know, we have the power, unfortunately, that sometimes we say things that, you know, make people feel worse. You know, there's nothing I can do. Or sometimes we can make people feel better with our words, which is, I'll be there for you, I'll help you. And this research looks at what are the words within the clinical encounter, not necessarily that the doctor says, but that the words that are associated with positive emotions and ones that are associated with negative emotions.
And this was published in the journal Healthcare, the Journal of Delivery Science and Innovation. And they looked at 407 patients, family members, nurses, and other healthcare professionals, gave them 67 expressions, and instructed them to sort them out into positive, negative, and neutral categories.
And they wanted to discover the ones that they were at least 80% or greater understanding their meaning. So, for instance, Christy, I'm going to give you a couple series of words here, and you can tell me, you can't look, can't cheat here, but do you think these are positive emotion words or
okay,
negative?
I won't look.
Enthusiastic.
Positive.
Grateful.
Positive.
Frustrated.
Negative.
Disgusted.
Negative.
Insecure.
Negative.
Accomplishment.
Positive.
Valued.
Positive.
Hopeless.
Negative.
Well, you 100%.
Man, I'm good.
And I think most of us would say that. And so you might say, well, this research is silly. We all know these are positive or negative. But I don't think so. I think this is important.
Well, I think there's real value in us thinking about, I mean, healthcare professionals and just people in families and people in relationships alike, realizing and highlighting the power of your words, and really thinking about choosing words that convey what you're trying to convey and being respectful of really listening carefully to one another. So I think there's something valuable, even though it seems intuitive to us reflecting on this.
Yeah, I think, Christy, we could do a whole show on this at some point in time, really.
I think that'd be fantastic.
Understanding better what words that we need to encourage use of, because those are the experiences we're trying to create.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we can try to do that. Well, let's talk about our next research that matters, though, which is about how people perform when they're kind of nervous and they're about to do something important, like they're going to the Olympics and they're about to do the figure skating jumps, or maybe they're about to make an important speech in front of a group.
Yeah, and so this is specifically talking about that performance anxiety, and trying to tease out ways to reframe it if there's a difference in how people perform if they reframe that anxiety into excitement.
And this was a recent study in the Journal of Experimental Psychology. We have some great names of journals today, Christy. But it was researchers that from the Harvard Business School that looked at, you know, challenging conventional wisdom, which is right before people are about to do something that's anxiety producing, you should say, people would say, well, what should you do? And people say, take a deep breath and calm down. And they gave experimentally people that advice versus, you know, get excited, say you're anxious in different ways to find out which made them perform better.
And they did this in the setting of having to do a karaoke video game, because that's a pretty anxiety-inducing task for some people.
For some people. You sing very well, so I don't know.
So, you know, it brings anxiety to everybody, I think. But anyway, the participants sang better when they told themselves they were excited compared with when they told themselves I'm anxious, or if they didn't say anything to themselves, they just went up and did it. So there was something, some implication to this value of reframing for yourself, not that I'm so nervous and I have to calm down and do it, but hey, yeah, of course I'm a little flushed and my heart's beating fast. I'm excited. I'm excited to go and do this. And that might help people.
Yeah, they also had people give speeches, and they, you know, had to say whether or not to tell themselves I am calm or I am excited. And sure enough, those who said they were excited actually performed better. And I think this is, as you mentioned earlier, this is framing, but this is also about perhaps challenging our conventional wisdom that, you know, we have to give ourselves the positive emotions here because it is anxiety producing.
Right. And excited is probably a positive word. And anxious is probably, or nervous is probably a negative word, getting back to the previous
research.
I'm
going to be excited when I see those those Olympic figure skaters about to do those triple axels, because I'm always worried they're going to fall.
Uh-huh.
And then it's hard for me to actually watch it. I get kind of real tense. And I'm going to say, I'm excited for them, and maybe they'll perform better.
That's wonderful. I hope it works that way, Adam. Okay. We've got two research studies to share. Really are just preliminary things that perhaps you should ask your doctor about or stay tuned for future research. The first one is about melanoma, particularly a new diagnostic and therapeutic technique for people who have metastatic melanoma, which is the kind that has spread through the body and you know, really has a very poor prognosis.
And this particular study that was in the Journal of Nuclear Medicine, it's really looking at are there better ways to diagnose this idea of being able to detect when metastases of the melanoma, which are sometimes very difficult to detect, which might influence your therapy earlier. Can you diagnose that better? And can you have then targeted markers here with these new gene therapy and these new nuclear techniques?
Yeah. Can you inject something in somebody's body that goes and finds that melanoma and then helps to target it? It's pretty exciting.
And they're getting closer.
Yeah.
Getting closer. And then, speaking of getting closer, this next final research that matters is about celiac disease or gluten sensitivity, an article that was in the journal Clinical and Experimental Immunology.
And celiac disease is hard to diagnose. You have to be, in most cases, eating gluten for many months to be able to get good intestinal biopsies and other tests. And a lot of people think they have it and don't. And other people might be having symptoms and not realize they have it. So the diagnosis has been a challenge, and this is a new test that might help with that.
Right. This was a particular test was to look at abnormal what's called T cell function, and they were really going to be able to have this cytokine test that they can potentially diagnose. I love the names of some of these other tests that are used. Immunoglobulin A anti-endomyosium antibodies, IgA anti-gliadin antibodies, and deactivated gliadin peptide antibodies. These are some of the most difficult names of any test in all of medicine. I like this one. It's an easier name. I hope it's better.
I hope it's better, too. But, you know, it's one of those things that's new, and it's something to perhaps stay tuned to and ask your doctor about if you're concerned about celiac disease.
Well, that'll conclude the research that matters. We've had a chance to talk about two new potential diagnostic tests that may move into mainstream.
About reframing anxiety into getting excited.
About words that do matter, and we're going to focus on those on an upcoming show.
And about the benefits of caffeine to enhance memory.
We'll take a short break, but when we return, we'll be talking with father-daughter co-authors, Mr. Mark Silver and Ms. Maya Silver, about My Parent or Friend Has Cancer. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today, Christy, on Conversations, we have a really unique opportunity to talk with the father and daughter co-authors, Mr. Mark Silver and Ms. Maya Silver, about their new book, My Parent Has Cancer and It Really Sucks, Real Life Advice from Real Life Teens. Thank you for being with us today on Your Health.
Great to be talking with you, Adam and
Christy. Thank you for having us.
You know, Mark, your wife and Maya, your mother, had breast cancer, and we want to get into some of the challenges and some of the lessons that you include in your book, but wonder if you would give us a little context about what really led you to write a book about your experience.
The biggest reason is that we went through this experience without a book like this, and reflecting back years after my mother had recovered, we realized that a resource like this would be extremely helpful to teens going through the experience. It was kind of hard when we were going through it to realize this lack of resources or what we might have needed, but in retrospect, it was very clear that something like this could really help the demographic that we were catering to, teens, sort of preteen, anywhere from 12 until 20. There was a lot of resources out there for younger children, sort of like picture books, or for older adults that are in a caregiving role toward a parent with cancer, but there was really nothing for my sister and I to turn to, and those were the days before the internet, too, so we felt pretty lost as far as resources and really wanted to give back from our experience and provide that for other teens going through the experience.
And it's funny, I mean, I didn't really initially see that there was a book. I had written a book for husband, breast cancer husband, because I knew I really needed a book, but the kids who were 12, 13, and 15 during Marsha's treatment, they just seemed fine. They seemed to be typical teenagers. They didn't seem to be greatly affected by the cancer diagnosis and all these treatments that we went through. So it just never occurred to me to ask them often, like, how are you guys doing? And I've learned so much in doing this research, both by talking to Maya and talking to other kids. And it turns out that teens are really very affected by a parent's cancer because of where they are developmentally. They're at a stage when they're pulling away from the family, they're forming their own identity, and then all of a sudden, mom or dad has cancer, and it yanks them back into the household, often with a lot of anger and resentment, sometimes with great love and care. But it was just fascinating to sort of understand that this is a very difficult age to deal with a parent's cancer.
Well, you know, one of the themes in your book, this guide to deal with cancer for children and teens, is that each child deals with their parents' cancer differently. What do you think contributes to how a child or a spouse reacts and deals with their loved ones, their mother's diagnosis? I mean, how did you do this, Maya, and how do you think this plays out?
Well, we address coping mechanisms in a whole chapter in the book, and it really is different for every teen what's going to work for them. Some teens, you know, are academic and really pour themselves into school and find that it's kind of a nice getaway during the week from family issues. And other teens are really socially plugged in and have great friends who are a great resource for them. And then there's a range of activities that a lot of teens turn to sort of you know, relieve their stress or express themselves through art and their feelings that they're going through, or just provide a welcome distraction from everything.
I
sort of use a mixture of those coping mechanisms. I definitely really wanted to be out of the house as much as possible. And I had great friends who I never really wanted to talk about the specifics with, but I knew they were there for me. I could go leave the house and go on a sleepover to sort of just get away from everything and feel better.
And it's interesting. I mean, there are so many ways kids cope, and even in the same family, two kids can cope very differently. And I remember interviewing one family where one kid just basically pulled a disappearing act, like she was never home, kind of like Maya was saying, but to the extreme where she was always over a friend's house, staying late at school, going to the mall. And it wasn't that she didn't care about her mom having cancer. It was just like, this is how she coped. And her sister, who was also a teenager, did the opposite. She did something that's the term that we learned is parentification, where the teenager takes on responsibilities that would normally fall to a parent. So this kid would do a lot of the caregiving at home and pick up chores and things like that. And that was her way of reacting to her mom's cancer. And the thing that's hard is, like, in a family like that, obviously you can imagine that the kid who was doing all the chores and the work at home resented the sister who was never home. So what we hope that the book can do is kind of show, well, these are both normal ways to react. It wasn't that one kid was bad and one was good. These are just different coping mechanisms.
Well, and when, just for context for me, I was a teenager with a father with cancer who passed away when I was 15. And one of the things related to what you're saying for me was that a lot of my friends didn't want to necessarily talk about that with me, or they didn't know what to say, and it was a little too heavy. And so you talk in the book about communication between parents and children, but there are also some complexities of the communication between peers. Did you find that to be true?
Yeah, absolutely. And we did have a few, you know, for the most part, there was sort of a range of people having friends that were really there for them, or friends that were sort of there for them but didn't quite know how to communicate with their friends about it.
Mm-hmm.
So they would say things that are maybe inappropriate or didn't make the teen who was going through their parents' illness feel better. We did have a few horrible cases where, like, a friend would just totally drop their friend when they told them that their parent had cancer. I think we had one case of this teen who was involved in theater, and her friend just told her, "I'm too busy right now. I don't have time to deal with a friend who has a problem like this." So that's
so
kind
hurtful.
Of the worst case scenario. But, you know, it's hard for teens. They haven't gone through enough life experience to really know how to talk about it and how to necessarily be.
And they're so
supportive.
Affected by peer pressure. That's the other thing that we found is, like, teens, like, a teenager doesn't want to be the kid in school whose mom or dad has cancer. They just want to be themselves. And that can be really hard. And it can be hard in interactions with friends, and it can be hard with teachers. I remember one girl told me a story. Her mom was going through breast cancer treatment, and one day in class, the teacher called on this girl to answer a question and says to the girl, "Oh, Caitlin, how's your mom?" And Caitlin was furious because she didn't want to talk about how her mom was right then and there. She wanted to answer the teacher's question. So what we hope the book can do is really, like, educate everybody, like, help teachers understand, help parents understand, and help kids understand. And what's really key is just, like, talking to each other about what you want. And this kid, Caitlin, said to me, "You know, if my teacher had asked me in a private moment how my mom was doing, that would have been fine. She just didn't want to have to broadcast a bulletin in the class that day." And I think that's so important for parents to talk to their kids, for teachers to be sort of in the loop, but also to understand, well, what does the family want in terms of classroom accommodations, in terms of, you know, how teachers might interact with the kid.
Well, Mark, I'd like to know what you think about this question, which is, you know, what do you tell – how much do you tell the teenager about what's happening? I've had – patients who have been reticent to tell their child how ill their mother was until, unfortunately, the mother had 3 days left, and the teen said, "God, we did know, and we wanted to know." What do you recommend? And then, Maya, what's it like to have someone else tell you what you can and can't know, and should you be the one to decide?
Yeah, I mean, we really recommend being pretty open with your kids. I mean, you don't have to tell them more than they need to know, but you do have to tell them what they do need to know, which would be, you know, what the disease is, what the treatments are, how it will affect the parent in terms of the way the parent and the kid, you know, get together. And if this means that, you know, mom isn't going to be driving carpool, or dad won't be able to, you know, go out on weekends with you to your soccer match, it's good to kind of spell all that out and to explain what's happening. And maybe it's a case where this is what it's going to be like for 6 months during treatment, and then after that we hope things will be better. Or maybe it's a different case where it's a more difficult disease to treat and it's ongoing. But it's like the kids really have to know and understand what's happening. The one thing they don't have to know necessarily is sort of how much pain the parent might be in. A lot of people have said, you know, it's like it's not, you just have to make a decision as a parent. Is it really important for the kid to know, you know, everything or not? And sort of what do they need to know that it would affect the way the kid's world works? So those are some kind of talking points. And also ask the kids, that's the other thing. You can tell them something, and the next day you could say, that stuff I told you about chemotherapy, was that too much information, or do you still have some questions? I mean, just keep a dialogue going. Don't dump some information and just walk away.
And for me, I mean, the most important thing was trust. And if a child finds out that their parent has been withholding information or skewing information, then you lose that trust, and they lose faith in what you're telling them. And for me, I wanted to have that from the beginning. When my dad said, you know, I think mom's going to be okay, her prognosis looks good, I immediately trusted him, and there was nothing after that that made me change my mind. And so that was really helpful, to just know that they weren't lying to me, they weren't painting a rosy picture, they were telling me what I wanted to know, answering my questions.
Yeah, and you assume kids know a lot, and they don't know a lot. They don't know. One kid said, I asked one teenager, what did she wish she knew about cancer when her mom was diagnosed? She said, I wish someone had told me that not everybody dies of cancer. So these kids might have their own perceptions and ideas, just as adults have their own ideas, and it's really important to kind of talk about stuff on a regular basis with your kids.
We do need to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue talking with our guests, father-daughter co-authors, Mr. Mark and Maya Silver, about My Parent or Friend Has Cancer. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with father-daughter co-authors, Mr. Mark Silver and Ms. Maya Silver, about My Parent or Friend Has Cancer, a conversation about a new book they've written called My Parent Has Cancer, and it really sucks. And, you know, Mark and Maya, in addition to you all just being so articulate about some issues and honest, you have some really interesting, I think, practical advice in your book. And I wonder if you could tell us about maybe a couple of different chapters. One of them I'm really interested in is you talk about dilemmas. What are the dilemmas, and how do you approach them?
Man, there are so many dilemmas. I mean, one dilemma that there are a lot of dilemmas that are very open and out there, like, oh, my mom can't take me to ballet. How am I going to get there? But there are all these dilemmas that kids are sometimes afraid to talk about. And this one therapist had told me a scenario where she was counseling a mother and daughter, and the daughter was like, I can't even be mad at you now, Mom, because you've got cancer. And part of being a teenager is you have the right to be mad at your parents.
At any time. Any time, by the way. I have a teenager.
Any time, yes. That's right. And this mother was great. She said, you know what? I can take it. You can be mad at me. So there are these things. And sometimes kids really feel like, oh, I wish the other parent had cancer. And then because maybe they're closer to dad than mom, or mom than dad. And then they would feel horrible for thinking that. And that's a real dilemma, too. And that's the way we are. It's like it's natural to be closer to one parent than the other, and you might have that thought. It doesn't mean you're a horrible person or that you don't, you know, it's just a normal reaction. So those are a couple of dilemmas that sort of are below the surface that people might be reluctant to talk about, but I think they could take a real toll if, you know, a kid is feeling bad about having those kind of thoughts.
And another big one that I definitely experienced was sort of a sense of embarrassment, especially when it's relating to a bald head. It's kind of an iconic symbol of cancer. And as a teen, you're trying to fit in or, you know, be cool, whatever, keep your appearance up. And then you have this cancer, for me, sort of felt like this elephant in the room that I never wanted to talk about. It was, like, kind of embarrassing. I didn't want people to feel bad for me. I didn't want people to think that I was going through something hard. I just wanted to blend in. And so for me, but then, you know, those feelings make you feel really guilty because you're like, oh, my God, how could I feel this way? My mom has cancer, and I'm embarrassed of it, and I don't want to talk about it. And it's a really complicated negotiation of emotions when you're that age. And so that's something we ran into a lot.
We heard one story about a bald dad, and the teenager was embarrassed and didn't want dad to come to school to see the teenager's swim meets. And it's like a really tough dilemma because part of you as a parent was to say, gee, I'm the same person. But you have to kind of think a little harder and say, oh, I understand this is really tough for the kid because, again, getting back to that peer pressure thing, maybe this kid isn't comfortable having, you know, dad or mom looking pale, involved in chemotherapy, showing up at school. And like, if a parent is really very noble and has a very saintly qualities, they might say, I understand how you feel. It'll only be for 3 months, and then chemo's over. And in the meantime, make a video of your swim meet, and I'll watch it with you at home. So just to try to bring out all these little possible scenes that can play out, I think it's helpful for kids to understand that, yeah, there are lots of dilemmas that come up, and talking about them is the best way to deal with them often. Although, as everybody has said, like, if a kid doesn't want to talk about it, that's the other thing. Parents might be like, you've got to talk about this, and some kids don't want to talk about it, and that's a dilemma. And one thing parents might do, obviously you want to respect your kid. You don't want to, you know, make them talk if they don't want to talk, but you might have a conversation. You know, the parents might talk among themselves when the kid is listening, because they'll know the kid is listening and there's information they want the kid to have. So there are ways to kind of get around that, too.
I mean, just thinking about one of your other chapters about the new normal. So, I mean, after a cancer diagnosis, life can't go back to the way it was before. What, regardless of the outcome, something big has happened and something has changed. What do families typically experience in their new normal, and how do you, or what do you recommend to families to prepare for and adapt to the new normal after a diagnosis like that?
Well, one positive thing we did find is sort of an increased sense of communication and positivity in the family. They really appreciate each other. They make sure to say, I love you, whenever they say goodbye or leave for the day. And they've really developed, a lot of them, these communication styles, the ability to talk to each other in an organized way over family meetings or over dinner and to convey important information. And a lot of teens really reflect upon the experience as something that matured them or taught them a lot of life lessons. So those are some of the more positive aspects of moving on after that experience.
But mom and dad, in a way, might not realize, like, you know, 6 months or a year has gone by, maybe the teenagers become more independent going through this period when mom or dad was dealing with cancer, and then all of a sudden, you know, the parents are back in action, and they're giving you curfews, and they're parenting you the way you were before cancer, and that's a tough situation, too, and that's where you might be able to have some kind of conversation, and the kids have to recognize, yeah, your parents are still your parents, but the parents might have to recognize, you know what, my kid has grown up a little bit more, and I have to sort of think differently about how I raise them.
You know,
what kind of restrictions I put in.
You know, it.
And kids also get impatient with their friends. That's the other thing a lot of kids share with us. They felt like, you know, wow, I've been through mom or dad's cancer, and my friends are worried, like, oh, I couldn't find the sneakers I wanted at the mall or whatever. And obviously, if you say those things to your friends, if you say, oh, you're so shallow, you're not going to have friends anymore. So you have to kind of play it by ear in terms of what you're willing to share with,
that's
with
an
your
important lesson.
Annoying friends.
You know, it. I understand that your wife, Mark, your mother, Maya, is doing well now. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
And
good health.
And we're thrilled to hear that. We also know that many parents that have cancer may succumb to their disease. And I wonder, how does your experience, or at least the advice and you've learned and heard from others, for those who lose a parent, is this advice relevant, or does it change?
I mean, it definitely changes. And we did have chapters in the book dealing with, you know, facing a dire outcome and losing a parent, because it's like you said, not everybody will be in that situation, but we felt like the book needs to speak to those kids. And it's really tough because you're thrown into a period of mourning and loss, and you sort of want to connect with the parent while they're still alive and don't always know how to do it. And we just tried to talk about how different families, you know, parents would share information. Sometimes, like, the parent would have a special night out with the daughter, a special night out with the son, and they could ask any questions they wanted to and just talk about stuff and how important it was to have certain kinds of keepsakes. Like, you know, some kids, when they would graduate from high school, would want to have a picture of their mom or dad in their, you know, in their shirt pocket, or carry a watch or whatever as a remembrance. So there are all these kinds of ways that kids cope. And what's hard is that sometimes in school, the teachers and administrators might not quite understand that and might lose patience with a kid who's sort of still suffering the loss of a parent. And we, you know, I remember talking to one kid whose father had died, and this kid was kind of hanging out in class and not, you know, not really doing his work and falling asleep and being mean to people. And I think he was called to the vice principal's office, and the vice principal was like, you know, it's been 6 months, get over it. And the thing is, you don't get over it. It's like, mm-hmm. mourning is a ongoing thing, and it comes in spurts, and sometimes you might feel okay, and the next day it might be the anniversary of losing a parent, or the day that you would have gone to the ball game with dad. And it's just really important for schools to understand that the teens really do grieve the loss of a parent over a long period of time.
Well, I mean, just thinking back to my own adolescence and the lack of resources out there, any sort of books that were tailored towards teenagers, I think that I would have gotten a great deal of support from having a book like this. And we're certainly grateful that you have taken the effort, both of you, to share your experiences and to put that to paper in a really user-friendly way that I think will touch teenagers with both kinds of outcomes.
Thank you. And we were just so fortunate. We met many teenagers. We must have interviewed 100 kids, and they were so willing to share their own, you know, their own experiences. And I think that's what makes a book like this speak to a bigger audience, because it's not just, you know, our story or one kid's story. It's lots of kids who've done all the things we've talked about and a million different things as well in reacting to a parent's cancer. Although they all agree that it pretty much does suck.
Surely, I would concur.
Well, we want to thank you, Mark Silver, you, Maya Silver, for being with our listeners today on Your Health. I think you're making things better for those who have had difficult journeys. And I would encourage all of our listeners out there who have loved ones with parents and children, to read this together, to buy this, and because it's a great resource, and we'll certainly make a link to it on our site. So thank you for being our guest today on Your Health.
Thank you. It was wonderful talking with you both.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I get to spend a little while talking about your health questions and your concerns.
If you have any questions you want Christy and I to discuss on an upcoming show, please send them to us at yourhealth.unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our executive producer, Erica Lloyd, to read us our very first House Call question today about electronic cigarettes.
I started using electronic cigarettes as a way to stop smoking. After 1 month, I found that I was still smoking and now using electronic cigarettes as well. I decided using both may be worse than cigarettes alone, even though I was still smoking less cigarettes. What do you think?
Well, I think, first of all, congratulations that you're trying to stop smoking. And congratulations on smoking less cigarettes. I don't know that we'll have a clear answer to your question, but my feeling is that if you're smoking less cigarettes, that's a good thing.
You know, this is a complicated question. And in general, we really do support anyone smoking less cigarettes. However, there's also this piece that, you know, people really should be trying to quit here, and we should be helping people quit. And we have to remember there are 7 Food and Drug Administration approved medications that have proven track records in helping people quit. And the highest rate is with those who use combination nicotine replacement therapy or varenicline. We have very little data on electronic cigarettes and their long-term impact on helping people quit, nor do we have enough data on safety, nor do we have enough data on what happens when people use electronic cigarettes and continue to smoke. So I agree, Christy, trying to quit smoking, cutting down, less cigarettes, it's a good thing. But hopefully this is on the path to quitting. That's the piece we have to remember.
I think the most important thing is that you don't just sort of say, okay, I decided to quit the electronic cigarettes, so I'm just going to go back to smoking what I was. That you stay committed to quitting smoking and you go and talk to your doctor about it, see about these medications that are available and other support, and, you know, keep trying. It takes most people many tries before they actually quit, but you've got to keep working at it and quit those cigarettes. It's the best thing you could do for your health.
Yeah, and last thing, remember that the Food and Drug Administration has announced that they intend to ultimately regulate electronic cigarettes, but they're not regulated, the manufacturing. Mm-hmm. So you really don't know fully what you're getting. And that's a little worrisome to me as a provider.
That's a good point. Okay, let's take our very next house call about the medication Abilify.
I'm 65 years old, and my doctors have given me the medication Abilify for depression. When I read about this, I found out it costs over $800 a month, and it's an antipsychotic, not an antidepressant. I decide I shouldn't take it anymore. What do you think?
I think you should talk with your doctor.
Absolutely.
There's a few red flags here, some areas of concern here. Like, why did your doctor give you this medicine?
And that could be because your depression is more complicated. Sometimes this medicine is used if there are features of a related diagnosis called bipolar disorder, or it can be used for a number of different things, including depression. But your depression might be a little bit more complicated, so it'd be good for you to understand why it was worth a try. The cost is also super important to talk to your doctor about. The doctor may not know that it costs that much.
Well, and also the insurance companies continue, and the pharmacy benefit companies, I like that term, pharmacy benefit companies, mm-hmm. but they may have some incentives for why certain medications are preferred or not, generic, not generic. So who knows? And this, but you can't obviously afford, and most people couldn't afford to take a medicine that costs them out of pocket $800 a month.
We recommend that you go make an appointment with your doctor, go right back in there and say, thank you so much for giving me that prescription. But here are my two concerns. One, I can't pay $800 a month. And two, I'm not quite sure why this medicine is most important. And let's talk about it.
Yeah, there's some antipsychotic medications that are less expensive, mm-hmm. maybe have a different side effect profile. And then there's some antipsychotic depression medications that are very inexpensive. So thank you for that question.
Other options.
Erica, what's our very next house call?
I have a large spacing in my abdomen that a friend said is called a ventral hernia. I don't have any pain, but it looks really ugly when I'm swimming or outside in the sun. I could have it fixed, but I heard it's not simple. What are your thoughts?
Oh, that's complicated. I would love to meet you and sort of talk with you about this and see this thing. But I think a lot of it has to do with how much it bothers you, and you sort of weigh that out. With a lot of people have a small ventral hernia or one that's didn't really bother you. And in that case, there may be some leeway to have this done only if it starts to bother you.
Yeah, we agree. This is not a simple surgery. I mean, we think of hernia surgeries a lot of times as something fairly simple. But the ventral hernias are much bigger frequently, and you have a large piece of what we call mesh. And mesh is what it looks like and sounds like to help provide that gap, bridge it, and then pull that all together. And I've had patients have very satisfactory results for that. I've also had some patients have some difficult times with that surgery because a lot of times people who need to have that type of surgery who have ventral hernias are very overweight. So that makes the surgery higher risk, and without losing that weight, the surgery may not hold and the skin could come apart.
The other thing you could do is, you know, if this is really bothering you because of swimming and being outside and that sort of thing, is you could get your doctor to refer you to a surgeon and then just talk with the surgeon about the positives and the negatives and the potentials of having it, and that can help guide your decision making.
Good answer.
Thank you. Let's take our very last house call question.
I'm a 40-year-old man who went to the ER with chest pains. Two visits and over $3,000 later, I was told I have panic attacks. I thought only women get panic attacks.
Nope. Clearly, we know that from your experience, which thank you for sharing with us. And thank you for reminding us that men get panic attacks.
Yeah, men definitely get panic attacks. Many of my patients, both male and female, have this problem. And it can be so scary. It can feel like your chest is going to explode, that you can't catch your breath, and it can give you many of the symptoms that are very descriptive of a heart attack. And so it's scary. It feels like a heart attack. So you did the right thing by seeking medical care. And it's unfortunate, but it's also fortunate that they discovered it wasn't an actual heart attack, even though it cost you a lot. It's good news in the end.
That was an expensive lesson, but we thank you for sharing it with our
listeners.
That's
right.
Well, that'll conclude our house calls today, and we want to thank all of you for contributing to your health, and we hope that if you have any questions, you can send them to us at yourhealth@unc.edu.
Follow us online at yourhealthradio.org, follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and get our health app where you can listen to the show anytime you want.
And we want to thank you for joining us today. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns important to you and your health. We had so many issues today, Christy, from electronic cigarettes and people cutting down to all kinds of other practices and research and conversation. Good show.
Thank you. We want to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, our guests today, Mark Silver and Maya Silver, and we want you to join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page. We'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.